The following lecture is provided by Biblical Training. The speaker is Dr. Douglas Moo. For more information, go to www.biblicaltraining.org.
Paul's continuing, in one sense, the series that he started in 1:13, talking about his early connections after his conversion, these years, as he was sort of learning the gospel and reflecting on it, getting his early preaching. We've talked about where 2:1 to 10 fits in the chronology of Paul's life. One of the issues is whether we have in 2:1 to 10 a kind of a public or a private consultation. Again, it depends on some technical issues in the Greek text here, which we won't go into right here. But once more, I do think the NIV has it right here. Verse 2, I went in response to a revelation and meeting privately with those esteemed as leaders, I presented to them the gospel that I preach among the Gentiles. And I do think that makes sense of the story as a whole, that what we have here is not the rather public, broad consultation that Acts 15 seems to suggest, but a more private kind of consultation with some of the key Jerusalem apostles. Paul coming up from Antioch and bringing Barnabas and Titus along. The scenario here would be right at the beginning of Acts 15. You have Paul having just returned from the first missionary journey, arriving back in Antioch. The rumors about what Paul is doing begin to circulate. People in Jerusalem express some concern about what's going on with Paul. Then you have the Jerusalem Council. What Paul is describing here, in my view, is earlier than that, something that takes place before that event and in the context, again, of something that was before the first missionary journey entirely. Now, Titus is significant, of course, in the story because he was a Gentile in background. And yet, as Paul points out, he was not compelled to be circumcised, verse 3. Actions speak louder than words. Paul's purpose here is to indicate to the Galatian Gentiles that there was no insistence when he met with the chief apostles, the pillar apostles, James, Peter, and John, that Titus, even though a Gentile, had to be circumcised. So that is obviously an important matter in terms of the actual policy of what happened there. The issue for Paul ultimately, as he indicates, is the truth of the gospel that he preaches among the Gentiles. So for Paul, central to the message of the good news is the free offer of salvation to anyone who responds to Christ in faith. And he was very reluctant to sort of load that with any other specific requirements. Now, that's something we're going to be talking about in terms of what that looks like in practice, and we can do that better with some other texts that are coming along in Galatians. But it does raise those questions, I think, about, well, if Paul is saying the free offer of the gospel shouldn't be contingent on the obedience to the law on the part of the Gentiles, is there any kind of contingency then? What is the expected conclusion of the matter once one has embraced the gospel? Aren't there standards of behavior that one has to expect, even if it may not be conformity to the law? And that's Galatians 5 and 6 is where Paul turns his attention to some of those things. In verses 6 and following, Paul talks about the apostles again, those who are held in high esteem, those who are reckoned to be pillars, he also says later on. The language Paul uses here is trying to cut a very fine path, a very narrow path, as it were, between, on the one hand, giving the apostles too much credit, you know, acting as if Peter and James and John were sort of the final arbiters of Christian truth, because Paul does not want to admit that. But on the other hand, to recognize that they do have an appropriate place in the church, they should be accorded respect because of the position they do have. Some have noticed that, particularly if you read the Greek text here, Galatians 2:1-10 is full of very convoluted Greek. And it's precisely because Paul is trying to carefully balance these two kind of ways of looking at things. He's trying to steer a very narrow course between appropriate respect for them without giving them sort of an undue position of influence or responsibility that he doesn't think any human being should have in the church. The key point, of course, is expressed in verse 7. They, that is Peter, James, and John, recognized that I'd been entrusted with the task of preaching the gospel to the uncircumcised, just as Peter had been to the circumcised. God, who was at work in Peter as an apostle to the circumcised, was also at work in me as an apostle to the Gentiles. So James, Cephas, and John gave me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship when they recognized the grace given to me. The specific ministry of grace is probably what Paul means here. They did agree that they would have separate sort of focal points in their ministry, Paul working mainly with Gentiles, Peter mainly with Jews. This shouldn't be seen, however, and some interpreters have done this, as a sort of two separate gospels, you know, a gospel for the Gentiles and a gospel for the Jews. There's only one gospel. Paul's very clear about that, I think. But as we understand in the preaching we do in different parts of the world, to different kinds of audiences, there is an appropriate sort of contextualizing of that central message that can go on in terms of meeting the needs of various audiences and speaking in terms that particular audiences will resonate with and respond to. And I think that's what's being reflected here. They did, however, ask that Paul should continue to remember the poor, the very thing that he'd been eager to do all along. This might be the earliest reference to the collection for the saints in Jerusalem. Here's where the chronology comes involved. Remember, on the third missionary journey, Paul was very much interested in collecting money from the Gentile churches to send to the Jewish Christians in Jerusalem, the collection, we call it. Paul talks about it in Romans 15, 1 Corinthians 16, and then at some length in 2 Corinthians 8-9. So in all three of these passages written on the third missionary journey. Now, remember that some people date Galatians on the third missionary journey also. Those who take the kind of North Galatian audience theory see this written at about the same time as Romans. And particularly if we date it then it might be that verse 10 is a reference to the collection. I doubt that it is. I think it's just a more general kind of a concern that the apostles would have had. But it does raise this question, I think. Granted what's going on here, the agreement that's being reached about the kind of essence of the gospel, that you don't have to circumcise the Gentiles for them to be included in the people of God, kind of pretty fundamental agreement about the gospel. Why do you think the one thing that's mentioned here has to do with collecting money for the poor? You know, of all the things that could have been mentioned at this point, Peter, James, and John basically saying to Paul and Barnabas, we grant that you are preaching the gospel faithfully. We agree Gentiles don't need to be circumcised. Let's shake hands on that, agree with that. But here's the one thing we still want you to do. You know, and the one thing is remember the poor. Why is that the one mentioned here?
For one thing, create a bond between the two.
Between the rich, the richer and the poor.
And the
Gentiles. Okay. Just so this would help to, how would that help to create a bond between the Jews and the Gentiles?
They have given out the riches of the gospel.
Uh-huh.
And if you have enjoy spiritual riches, then those who are in need now should enjoy.
Now, are you assuming the poor are Jewish Christians? Why do you think that would be the case?
Well, Jesus prophesied that there would be all kinds of destitution that would come upon them. I was thinking that they were seeing the clouds coming in of all of the persecution and the Roman oppression that was going to come on them when they were driven out.
Okay, so you think because of those that historical circumstance and Jesus' prophecy that the reference to the poor here is probably specifically to Jewish Christians who are poor. And this is, again, where the parallel with the Romans 15, for instance, would come into play if this is a reference to the collection also, because there it's pretty clear the poor are identified with particularly Jewish Christians in Jerusalem. I guess, again, the question is that the context here? Is there anything here to make it so clear? Yeah.
Isn't it the famine? I mean, they're bringing a collection to help.
If the famine relief visit is what's indicated here. Exactly. If the famine relief visit is what's indicated here, then that might be another particular background. And we've suggested there's some reason to think this might be the same situation as the Acts 11:27-30. Yeah.
So some of the commentators said there was because of war, overpopulation,
right,
other things going on there,
yeah,
there were some great needs among the Jews in Jerusalem.
Yeah, in other words, there were some pretty clearly identifiable factors leading to the famine that they're experiencing. Yeah, yeah.
Could it be that the apostles in Jerusalem were just asking Paul and his associates to kind of act in solidarity with them, because that was one of the distinguishing marks, even like in Acts 4, that the people gave in common? And so it's like, in a sense, the Jerusalem apostles were kind of conceding to Paul, yes, but now we're asking for this concession from you, to just act in solidarity to show that your faith is genuine in this way, because this is the mark of a Christian, is that we give what's in common to help those who have need.
I think that's not a bad way to put it, Jim. Thank you for summarizing, in a sense, for us here, some things I was going to say as well. Yeah, I think that we have sometimes forgotten how important this dimension was for the early church, in other words. Bruce Longenecker has recently written a pretty thick book on, with the title from this verse, Remember the Poor, and talking about how important this concern for meeting the needs of the poor was for the early church and for Paul. And that in that context, this verse then makes a certain amount of sense. Whether the poor be specifically Jews or not, there's still obviously that sense of obligation to, as the gospel is preached, make sure that these practical implications of the gospel are not lost sight of, and that the Gentiles are brought into that sense of a community in which sharing and assisting those with particular needs is a fundamental value. Kind of like a family value that they want to make sure the Gentiles who are joining the family of God share with those who are already there. David, do you have a question?
I think and I may be reaching out a little bit here, one thing is that they'd already had an issue where food was involved and distribution of food was involved.
Yeah.
And I think that may have been on their minds, and they don't want to, with everything going on, come back into that type of a situation.
Mm-hmm.
What's strange to me is they're asking us that Paul, who's working with Barnabas, and Barnabas is a Levite, they have shown in their ministry that they would not neglect the poor. And why they stress that, knowing that Barnabas, whom they named Barnabas, son of consolation,
yes,
why they would think that he would ever get away from being who he was.
Maybe they were afraid about Paul's influence on him. You know, you're right to say Barnabas is sort of this transitional figure, obviously someone who's respected by the authorities in Jerusalem because of his early history with them and so on, but now he's traveling around with Paul and is becoming under his influence, and so maybe, you know, the pillars, as it were, are worried that Barnabas is being corrupted by Paul a bit or something, or shunted into a different way of viewing things by Paul. Yeah, that's a good point. Let's talk about preaching just for a moment again. Here's another challenging text to preach, I think. Paul talking about, narrating a meeting that he had in Jerusalem over these issues. What would be key preaching points out of a text like this?
Well, Paul is an interesting dynamic here, because he's, if I'm reading it right, he's going to the apostles to submit to them to see if he hasn't run in vain idea. And yet when he finds someone who's opposing his gospel, he stands against them very strongly. So he's willing to recognize and submit to the authority structure that God has put in place in the church, while at the same time opposing any subversion of the gospel.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. You're absolutely right. The language he uses there, you know, I presented them the gospel I preach, wanted to make sure I was not running in vain. So he clearly thinks the approval of the three is going to be pretty important somehow, at the same time as he doesn't surrender his independence. And that would then translate into some principles for us in terms of the fine line between, and this is a tough one for a lot of us as Christians, I think, to follow, the tough line between respecting people who are over us in legitimate ways in the church, and yet insisting that my own reading of Scripture, my own engagement with Christ, the work of the Spirit in my own life is nevertheless the decisive thing. And sometimes we have trouble negotiating that particular point of conflict.
There's the idea that we're not all called to the same ministry exactly. We all have our own ministries. Peter was to the circumcised. Paul was to the uncircumcised.
Mm-hmm.
So we all have our place in the kingdom work.
But you would think that Paul would be better suited to go to the Jews due to his training.
It's not what God had in view for him, you know. Sometimes we see that happening, that you know, you see someone who's trained a certain way, had a certain upbringing, you think, oh, surely this is where they belong, but God has other ideas. And from a strictly human standpoint, if you want someone who's going to break new ground by reaching out to a particular group, you want them, in a sense, to have strong credentials with the original group, because then they'll be trusted. I think that's why God used Peter. Peter's the one who had the vision at the house of Cornelius, because then when he came back and said, this is what happened, this is what God seems to be doing, he had credibility because of who he already was. So Paul, with his strong and rich Jewish heritage, is eminently capable then of sort of being trusted to build that bridge to the Gentiles, I think. The obvious point in the paragraph, again, that I highlight up here, too, is this matter of the truth of the gospel, which I think is something that is of deep concern for Paul. Obviously, in some ways, it's the theme running through chapters 1 and 2. Paul's exposure and understanding of the truth of the gospel and his attempt to defend that truth, both in Jerusalem, 2:1 to 10, and in Antioch, verses 11 to 14. The passion that Paul had for the truth of the gospel, at the same time as he's willing to engage in discussion with people about that, so that he, again, as we've seen, doesn't submit to the Jerusalem apostles, but certainly is willing to put his gospel before them. 2:11 to 14. Here is this, again, dispute in Antioch. We talked a little bit earlier this morning, you might remember, about the chronology. It's difficult to be sure just when this incident took place. Paul, in the earlier verses here we've seen, he uses specific chronology. After 3 years, verse 18, then I went, and so forth. After 14 years, 2:1. Now in 2:11, it's more general. When Cephas came to Antioch. You know, when was that? And we can't be absolutely sure when that took place. David, you might have heard this morning, made the case for a chronological sequence here, that it would make some sense for this to have taken place after the agreement in Jerusalem. Well, I understand that was your argument, David. I think most commentators tend slightly to go that way here, that it makes a little bit more sense of the sequence. Obviously, Paul brings it, well, I shouldn't say obviously maybe, but Paul brings it up, I think, among other things, because he knows the Galatians have probably heard about this. If we're right about the churches Paul is addressing, those churches in southern Galatia aren't that far away from Antioch, the sending church over in Syria. They've probably heard about this incident, and maybe they've heard a report that's slanted one way or another. So Paul is concerned to say, now, you may have heard what happened here. I'm not sure what kind of report you've received, but I want you to know what really happened. He describes the incident here to us. Men from James have come. Whether they have honestly been representing James or not is uncertain. In other words, the text tells us they came from James. Did James commission them with the particular message they brought? Or were they just claiming to represent James and were perhaps not representing him fairly? We just can't know for sure what the situation was in terms of James' role in the matter. The background is what's crucial to understand here. Jews in Paul's day were not uniformly prohibited from eating with Gentiles. That was not always a prohibited thing. You couldn't say that even in terms of the oral law of the Jews at the time, it would have been wrong for a Jew always to eat with a Gentile. But there were those who were so concerned about contamination from the Gentiles that they did establish that as a perspective and rule. The intertestamental Jewish book Jubilees says, "Eat not with them, for their works are unclean." So these attitudes were out there. And from Acts itself, and this is Peter speaking, very interestingly, "You're well aware that it is against our law for a Jew to associate with Gentiles or visit them." So while Jews would eat occasionally with Gentiles, there was a certain movement among the Jews to pretty much break off any significant contact with Gentiles. Because Gentiles were idolaters, Gentiles were involved in all kinds of idolatrous behavior, and Jews obviously wanted to avoid any association with that. So perhaps the scenario is something like this. People in Jerusalem have heard about the movement of God in bringing Gentiles into the Christian community. Remember, Antioch was the first place where people were called Christians. Acts 11, precisely because you have Jews and Gentiles now joining together in a kind of third race, neither Jew nor Gentile, a mixed group that you have to call something else, and hence they were called Christianoi in the book of Acts. People, again, in Jerusalem are hearing about this, maybe in a bit of a garbled way, and are very concerned that this news is going to undercut any attempts they are making to evangelize fellow Jews. If they are going to have any success convincing fellow Jews that Jesus is the Messiah and to acknowledge that and find forgiveness of sins in him, they're also, in their view, going to have to convince their fellow Jews that this is not a kind of separatist movement. You're not going to have to stop being a Jew in order to embrace Jesus as the Messiah. And this matter of eating meals together in Antioch could apparently have sent a very unfortunate signal. It could have hampered evangelistic efforts in Jerusalem. This was also a period of time in which the so-called zealot movement, most of you, I'm sure, have heard of the movement and know the word. the biblical idea of zeal for the Lord lent its name to a movement of the Jews about this time, a strongly nationalistic movement in which Jews were joining together to resist the oppressor Rome, to resist any pagan influence, to resist the Gentile domination, to fight for Israel's liberty as an independent theocracy again. All of these were strong social and political pressures on the Jews living in Jerusalem, in which you could understand them saying, please go up to Antioch and tell the Jewish Christians there to stop eating with Gentiles, because it's really undercutting all of our efforts here in Jerusalem to evangelize among our fellow Jews. It's just really hurting our reputation. So tell Peter, please, to stop eating with the Gentiles. The argument is convincing, it seems, to both Peter and to Barnabas, who withdraw from their shared meals with the Gentiles. And Paul is incensed at this. He says, I opposed Peter to his face. I got in his face. We could maybe use the modern idiom almost here. Because for him, the truth of the gospel was at stake. So what's interesting about this incident, first, I think, is the fact that some of these very practical matters, like eating together, can take on both theological and social importance. And that negotiating some of these issues and questions becomes complicated because of these competing motives and concerns. You can understand, I think, at least I can understand, some of the Jews in Jerusalem arguing the point they were making. Oh, it's just a concession. Please don't eat with them anymore, because by withdrawing, you will help us in our efforts to evangelize Jews. This is a good cause, obviously. Let's not rock the boat. Let's not do anything unnecessarily to create consternation among the Jews. Let's try to remain loyal and have, therefore, success in bringing more and more Jews into this messianic community. So there, Peter and James on the one side, and then Paul on the other, who is just absolutely opposed to this and claims it's a betrayal of the truth of the gospel. Because for Paul, of overriding consideration is this unifying effect of the gospel. Now, we'll talk about the new perspective a little bit later this afternoon, but you begin to see where that sort of new perspective approach begins to come in here. The truth of the gospel for Paul here seems to be not so much faith and grace. The truth of the gospel seems to be Gentile inclusion on equal terms with the Jews. You see that flavor here, I think, in some of the language Paul is using. So clearly, for Paul, Peter has betrayed his understanding. He is a hypocrite. Paul uses that language here. Someone who is acting in a way that is contradictory to what they really believe. We know what Peter really believes. Acts 11 tells us that. Acts 15 tells us that. Paul records an agreement that tells us that. And now, yet, Peter is acting in a way not in keeping with that. Now, did Peter see it that way? I think it's a legitimate question to ask again. It would be fascinating to hear Paul and Peter debating this in front of us, to hear both their viewpoints. And I'm not trying to undercut what Paul is saying here. Obviously, what he says is inspired scripture for us. So that's the final word. But you can imagine Peter defending himself. Paul, I'm not betraying any principle here. You know, I'm not changing my view. If I stop eating with the Gentiles, that's just a sort of temporary concession for the sake of preaching the gospel more successfully among the Jews. I'm not being a hypocrite. I'm not, departing from my own view, nor do I see my behavior as departing from that view, where Paul says, no. By failing to eat with the Gentiles, you are sending a signal. You are basically saying Gentiles are by definition people who are still unclean idolaters and I, as a Jew, can have nothing to do with them. That is contrary to the gospel, according to which, by faith and by grace, everybody, Jew and Gentile alike, is brought into the kingdom of God and therefore need to associate together as equals in the kingdom of God. This is Paul's argument, you see. I'm going on and on here, but again, I think it's a fascinating story. It reminds me of a lot of the issues we fight through in our own day when we're trying to negotiate issues of principle and concession for the sake of ministry on the other. How far do we concede? What kind of concessions do we make? When do those concessions betray the gospel? When do those concessions foster the gospel? Those are not easy decisions always to make. And I think, again, the window here into this debate in Antioch between Peter and Paul is really interesting in that light. One of the points that clearly emerges from the paragraph is, again, that certain social conventions, if we may call them that, carry significant consequences and send significant signals. It's often pointed out, as I'm sure most of you are aware, that eating together in the ancient world had much, much greater series of significances than it does in our day. Today we, you know, do lunch with business associates, and it's a pretty casual thing. You can do it with anybody, anytime. But sitting at a table together in the ancient world carried consequences. That's why eating together in Antioch became so significant in the Jewish world and the broader Greco-Roman world of which Antioch was a part. Now, your comments and questions. We've not gone through the text in any detail, but I think I've summarized the text pretty well by what I've said. But first of all, any questions on the text itself, and then broader questions about the issues we've been talking about?
When he opposed him to his face, did that mean he took him privately, or did he do it in front of the whole congregation?
Well, it's not clear what's going on in verse 11, but verse 14 is clear. I said to Cephas in front of them all. So in light of that, I would take verse 11 to mean I opposed him directly and I did it publicly. So yeah, we'll see.
You're painting the picture that it was mainly Peter and the Jews withdrawing from eating with Gentiles because of evangelism back in Palestine.
I'm suspecting that's the case.
But what does the end of verse 14 mean, that Paul accused Peter of forcing the Gentiles to follow Jewish customs? Would the custom be eating separately?
That you're forcing Gentiles to follow Jewish customs probably means that, in effect, the Jews seem to be saying you can only engage the gospel and be part of the people of God in Jewish terms. Sort of the guidelines, the context in which you could express your faith in Jesus Messiah were still very much dictated by the Jewish world, by the Jewish law, that these barriers were still in place.
So I have the New King James beside the NIV. The New King James says, why do you compel Gentiles to live as Jews?
Uh-huh. Yeah, or to force Gentiles to follow Jewish customs, I think it comes with the same thing.
Typically, then, it's Peter is then forcing the Gentiles to do that by removing his fellowship?
By removing his fellowship, Peter is saying the terms of the people of God are still being dictated by the Old Testament Jewish tradition. Those are still in place. And if Gentiles then want to participate in meals with the Jews, they apparently have to do it on their terms, whatever that might involve, in terms of circumcision and the law.
So it's not necessarily specifics that Paul is accusing him of? It's not that Peter's been preaching circumcision or he started preaching circumcision?
No, I don't think so. No. No, I think Paul is saying the effect of what you are doing is this. Maybe you haven't even realized that yourself, but that's the effect of what you're doing. Anything else on 2:11 to 14? All right, now we're going to make a transition, and we're going to be doing this each of our days. The rest of the afternoon, we're going to look a little bit more broadly at issues of Paul's theology raised here. So I need to change my PowerPoint. We're not going to do a full investigation of the theology of Paul, obviously. We would not have time to do that. But as the text of Galatians brings up some of these broader issues and certain vocabulary or ideas come up there, I'm concerned that we broaden out a bit and to look at those broader issues as well. I think this is, again, part of good biblical preaching. We talked about expository preaching and tried to discuss a little bit of what a definition might be there. And I'm not sure what a definition is or what my definition would be. But I'm concerned for effective proclamation in our churches that forms people as those who can think Christianly and therefore will live Christianly. Forming people to have good, solid Christian minds requires that we sometimes move beyond the text to bring in these larger issues of theology that the text raises. So we're just going to touch on some of these together. The first one is this framework of salvation history we've been talking about already. Going back to the beginning of Galatians, this present evil age, Paul, along with the other New Testament authors, takes over from a Jewish movement of that day called Jewish apocalyptic. It was a certain way of thinking about what God was doing in history. Don't need here to bother with the details. That's not important. But in this conception, there was a kind of very strong contrast between this age and the age to come. Certain forms of Jewish theology, and there were certain strains of this in the Old Testament itself, could suggest a kind of more organic movement of history. That is, no great climax or shift, but just sort of God eventually, through his purposes, through the servants he would send to Israel, you know, establishing his rule. The apocalyptic focus was more on a very climactic moment where things would change, where the old age again would cease to be and the new age would come into being. The New Testament picks up this conception of the old age and the new age, but gives it a twist in the light of Christ, because now we have not a single moment in time, we have two key moments in time. Messiah is not going to come once, Messiah is coming twice. So rather than having a kind of single point of transition from old age to new, in the New Testament perspective, as God has now in fact done things in revealing his Son, there is this transitional period between the old age and the new age. So with Christ's death, resurrection, the pouring out of the Spirit, the new age is inaugurated, but the old age has not simply ceased to exist. The old age continues. Satan is alive and well. Sin is still something we battle. Death and sickness and evil are still very much a part of our world. That world continues even as the new world has begun. And it will be at the return of Christ in glory that the old age will be finally judged and end, giving way to the new age of the new heavens and the new earth for eternity. So it's this whole idea of the present evil age that sort of reflects this scheme. And as we're looking at Galatians in particular, the question is, Christians are located right here, the new inaugurated, but the new not yet come to its climax. Here's where we're located. And the Judaizers, you see, are saying, the law continues and still is needed to mark off the people of Christ. Paul is saying, no, with the coming of Christ and the inauguration of the new age, that's changed. That's different now. So this becomes a key point of contention between them, just moving out of this basic scheme of salvation history. We'll see how important this is in understanding Galatians 3, and we'll come back to this then. Tomorrow or the next day, we'll be looking at Paul's argument in Galatians 3 about how God has revealed his purposes in history, and it'll be important for us to kind of have this basic scheme in mind then, certainly. I'm going to skip this for a moment, and I want to talk about the gospel now. Paul said a lot about the gospel in chapters 1 and 2. Oh, sorry, Jason?
Can you go back to your on that overlapping history slide? Yeah. So, like when Paul talks about or says the present evil age in 1:4, rescued us from the present or delivered us from the present evil age. Is he talking about the old age that we were rescued from?
Yes, I think so.
He's referring to the old age.
Yes.
Okay, not the present overlapping age.
Well, no, I mean it's both because the old age continues again. You see.
Been delivered definitively from the old age. Will be delivered with the present age in the future. So he's doing both of those in that phrase.
Say that again.
Well, he rescued us from the present evil age.
Uh-huh.
The present evil age means on your chart.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I think the past tense there is appropriate in English. Paul's saying, yes, ultimately there will be this definitive release from all the powers. But with the coming of Christ and with our response to Christ, we have now been definitively rescued from that age in the sense that we no longer belong there. We are no longer condemned to death. We are no longer under the power of sin. All of these things have happened because we now belong to Christ. And this is, in a sense, the new age is to what we really belong. So I think that, again, the past tense used in English probably accurately conveys the Greek there. That while, yes, it's true, ultimately there is this rescue that's going to come, Paul's reflecting on the rescue we've already experienced. That's right. Yeah.
So you're including in the present evil age the Old Covenant Mosaic Law?
In a certain sense. Paul is very careful about that. We commented on that this morning. On the one hand, it's very careful. It's very important that we not try to say, oh, the law is evil itself. But nevertheless, as Paul is going to argue, God's law, even though it was his good law given for positive purposes to his people, has been co-opted by sin and used by sin as part of this evil age, even though it itself is a good thing.
So it's not purely the secular world in the way that the Apostle John uses it, the world. We've been saved from the world.
It's similar, yes. It's similar, and again, the law is a tricky thing for Paul. You could see him in a place like Romans 7, for instance, struggling with this very point. Is the law sin? No. It's a good thing. It's God's gift, but nevertheless, it's been used by sin. And so who will rescue me from this law of sin and death? Law does end up having this negative effect. We'll talk about that more tomorrow because it's given to people who are already locked up under sin. The law, in a sense, just brings frustration then, condemnation, not because it's evil in itself. So in that sense, Paul's present evil age and John's world are not that different. Because it's not, you know, the world in John is not just a matter of the secular, it's also a matter of the religious that's not appropriately understood in terms of Christ. The gospel, or of course the good news, is language that's particularly important in Paul. That's what this simple diagram illustrates. The language, particularly in the noun form, is very common in Paul in comparison with the rest of the NT. So what you have here in the orange is Paul, and the blue is the rest of the New Testament altogether. And so you can see that for Paul, the language is really quite important. There's been quite a lot of discussion about the gospel in recent days. Just so we can get a little bit of a break and shift gears a little, I'd like you to look through Paul's use of gospel language. A two-page handout that everyone should have a copy of here. So take two sheets each. And what I'd like you to do is to get in three separate groups. look through these texts. There are a lot of texts here. You might not have time to go through all of them. But I'd just like you to reflect on what these texts teach about what the gospel is. Now, some of us might be saying, well, of course, we know what the gospel is. You know, why in the world do we have to spend time doing this? But in fact, there is quite a lot of discussion these days about just how we should define the gospel, the good news, how broad it is, how narrow it is. And there's nothing like getting acquainted with the actual evidence of the text itself. So spend about the next half hour or so, maybe let's say a little more than, let's say till about 2:45, in a group with four or five others, looking at these texts and asking the simple question, what for Paul is the gospel? Let me come up with a nice, neat definition on the basis of all of this evidence. What's the gospel?
Thank you for listening to this lecture brought to you by biblicaltraining.org. Feel free to make copies of this lecture to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter the content in any way without permission. We invite you to visit our website at www.biblicaltraining.org. There you will find the finest in evangelical teaching for use in the home and the church, and it is absolutely free. Our curriculum includes classes for new believers, lay education classes, and seminary-level classes taught by some of the finest seminary teachers drawn from a wide range of evangelical traditions.